Hi, this is Fred Zaspel, editor at Books at a Glance. We have with us today Andreas Kostenberger. He is the co-editor with Tom Schreiner of the book Women in the Church, An Interpretation and Application of 1 Timothy 2, 9-15. This is its third edition. And today we have Andreas with us. He is the professor of New Testament at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Tom Schreiner, who is not with us today, is professor of New Testament at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And Andreas is going to speak for Tom and for the rest of their team about their new book. Andreas, good to have you with us.
Hey, great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. Since your book is about 1 Timothy 2, 9-15, why don't we start with just a reading through the passage? Would you do that for us?
Well, absolutely. Let me read, maybe starting in verse 8 from the ESV. It says, "I desire then that in every place the men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Likewise, also that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly attire, but with what is proper for women who profess godliness with good works. Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. If she will be saved through childbearing, if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control."
All right, very good. Again, the title of the book is Women in the Church, An Interpretation and Application of 1 Timothy 2, 9-15, a contemporary subject and a very important passage for contemporary discussion, if ever there was one. Okay, Andreas, your title says it rather plainly, but tell us what your book is about and maybe why it was needed in 1995 and now again in 2016.
Our book is about the role of women and men in the church. It covers fairly exhaustively the most important passage that we just read on the issue, 1 Timothy 2, 9-15, from every conceivable angle, the ancient background, the meaning of the rare verb, authenteo, commonly translated to exercise or to have authority, the larger discourse context, the exegesis, the hermeneutics, and the application of the passage. Those who disagree with the natural reading of the passage, which is, "I don't permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man," continue to advance novel proposals that would change the plain meaning of this important apostolic command. And I think for that reason, it's vitally important for the best of scholarship to be applied to respond to these proposals and to return to the question at hand: what does 1 Timothy 2:12 mean, and what are the implications for the roles of women and men in the church?
All right, this book has a little history behind it. The first edition was 1995, as I mentioned. The second edition was 2005, 10 years later, and now the third edition in 2016. How is the third edition now different from the earlier ones?
Well, it's been very gratifying, especially with the endorsement of people such as Tom Piper and Don Carson. After the book first appeared in 1995, it established itself as the standard treatment on 1 Timothy 2. And then the second edition, 10 years later, kept interaction with the literature current and canvassed responses to the first edition. Now, another decade later, the third edition is doing the same thing, and then some more. There are brand new articles on the meaning of authenteo by Al Walters, probably the world's leading expert on that rare word. And also a brand new article on Bible translation by Danny Burke. The essays on background and hermeneutics were completely rewritten. Myself, I reran hundreds of lexical searches in the massive Thesaurus Linguae Graecae database and found dozens more parallels to the syntax of 1 Timothy 2:12. The chapter on exegesis was significantly updated by Tom Schreiner as well, but Perhaps the most helpful addition was a virtual round table on the application of the passage with participants such as Rosaria Butterfield, Mary Cassian, Gloria Furman, Darren Patrick, Tony Morita, and others. I think readers of our book will find a wealth of practical insight in this volume that they can put to use in serving Christ more effectively in the church today.
All right, the opening chapter by S.M. Bao talks about the culture of first century Ephesus. What's the purpose of this chapter? And with regard to your topic, why is all that important?
Well, as I sought to show in my book, Invitation to Biblical Interpretation, properly reconstructing the historical cultural background of any biblical passage is a very important part of interpreting it correctly. With regard to 1 Timothy 2:12, some have argued that somehow Ephesus was a unique or unusual city with regard to women's roles. So the myth of feminist Ephesus was born in an effort to show that Paul's prohibition of women teaching or exercising authority was embedded in an environment where women were dominant and must be put in their place. However, as S.M. Bao shows, Ephesian society was generally patriarchal, just as other comparable cities in the Greco-Roman world of the first century. It follows that Paul's instructions in this passage were not temporary measures, but meant to be applied in every place, as he says in 1 Timothy 2:8.
Okay, then, the big question. In 1 Timothy 2:12, the meaning of authenteo. Tell us about this word, its meaning, translation history, the debate around it today, and how you address it there in the book.
Certainly. So the word authenteo is found in the New Testament only in 1 Timothy 2:12. Even in extra-biblical literature, it's extremely rare and appears only once or twice prior to Paul using it in our passage. This, by the way, is why discourse context is extremely important in construing the meaning of the term. I'll have a chance to elaborate on that later in the interview. Al Wolters, in a compelling and painstaking chapter in the book, surveys all the available instances of authenteo in the first few centuries and concludes that the word refers to a person's exercise of authority in a non-pejorative and non-ingressive sense. Now, let me translate that into non-technical language. What that means is that women were not merely forbidden the improper exercise of authority, but any exercise of authority over men in the church, even the kind that would be appropriate for men to exercise over the congregation. And Wolters' research also cast doubt on the NIV rendering of the term assume authority, because he shows that the word does not refer to women taking up authority, as in assume authority, but to their exercise of authority over men in the church in general.
Okay, beyond the meaning of the word itself, give us a brief survey of some of the other factors in this passage that are significant in this discussion.
Well, because the term authenteo is so rare, other factors take on greater importance. Fortunately, the joined expression to teach, the Greek word didasko, is not rare at all in the letters to Timothy and Titus or elsewhere in the New Testament. It clearly means to teach. And the question then becomes what to make of Paul's prohibition of women from teaching or exercising authority over men in the church. In my chapter on the syntax of 1 Timothy 2:9 through 15, I show that Paul's underlying concern in the entire passage is one of following God's order in the church, with men being in charge of God's household, as in the natural household, and with women being in proper submission to the elders' authority. I also conduct an extensive search of parallels in the New Testament and elsewhere and examine 99 parallels, including 31 new ones not previously adduced. I conclude that authenten andros in 1 Timothy 2:12 ought to be understood positively as to exercise authority over a man, not merely in the sense of usurping a man's authority or of exercising authority in some sort of a domineering way.
Okay, tell us then about the significance of Robert Yarborough's chapter, Familiar Paths and a Fresh Matrix, the Hermeneutics of 1 Timothy 2, 9-15. What is the point he makes there?
I remember receiving Bob's chapter, and I was utterly fascinated. Bob discusses how a surprising number of female exegetes have interpreted the passage in non-feminist terms in recent years. He also provides a reading of 1 Timothy 2:9 through 15 from a non-Western perspective, which shows that interpreters in other cultures find the passage much more palatable and congruent with their own setting than those in our Western egalitarian society. You've got to buy the book and read Bob's chapter to get the full impact of his analysis. But what you'll see is that the problem is really not so much that the passage is unclear, as egalitarian interpreters continue to allege, but that the passage is inconvenient or even offensive for those whose ideological outlook differs. In non-Western cultures, people very often find the passage very clear indeed. In fact, they hardly embrace its teaching and take no offense whatsoever at Paul's prohibition of women teaching or exercising authority over men in the church.
Fascinating. Of course, there are many other exegetical issues in 1 Timothy 2 beyond the meaning of the particular word authenteo, and our readers will have to get the book for themselves to get the details, but can you give us just a brief summary of this passage, maybe an expanded paraphrase or an interpretive rendering or something?
Be glad to. We conclude the exegetical portion of the book with an emphatic conviction that the passage, rightly interpreted, means what it says and says what it means. Namely, I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man in the church. In fact, this is the way in which almost all English translations render the verse. And I refer you on this to Danny Burke's excellent chapter on Bible translation, one of the new chapters in the book. Once we've established the meaning of the passage, we then move on to application. What is the significance of the passage in the various settings in which we find ourselves today? Again, I really urge you to read the concluding round table to benefit from just the tremendous diversity of applications, all based on the interpretation set forth in our book that's shared by our panel of godly women and men from an amazing diversity of backgrounds. Our hope for those who read the book is not merely to inform the academic discussion, though I think we show that it is entirely possible to be highly intelligent and competent as a scholar and to embrace a conventional and conservative understanding of 1 Timothy 2, but our purpose and our hope is to equip the new generation of believers to live out God's design for men and women in the church, especially younger people and those who might not be as familiar with the debates of previous generations.
Great. Well, it's a great book. You've done great work on it. And you have written other books on related subjects as well. So before we go, maybe you could tell us about those. You've written on marriage, the family, and so on. And your wife, Marnie, has been involved mm-hmm. in some of that as well. Tell us about some of the other books on related subjects.
Absolutely. Well, the main book that I've written that deals with God's plan for marriage and the family is God, Marriage, and the Family. This book has been widely used in churches and premarital counseling and in seminary and college classrooms, and I've been very grateful to see it. It's been translated in several foreign languages as well. We've abridged this book under the title Marriage and the Family, Biblical Essentials. And, we found that this is an ideal resource if you want a quick but accurate review of what the Bible teaches on all kinds of issues related to marriage and the family, such as singleness, homosexuality, divorce and remarriage, and even many of the contemporary medical ethical issues related to marriage and the family. And then last year, my wife, Margaret, and I published a book called God's Design for Man and Woman, which lays out God's beautiful design for men and women. We traced it all the way from Genesis to Revelation. In that book, we show that God's design is for male leadership and for male-female partnership in the home, the church, and in mission for God. My wife also has written an important book on feminist views of Jesus called Jesus and the Feminists, Who Do They Say That He Is?, which is a revised version of her doctoral dissertation. And finally, if you're listening to this or reading this, if you're interested to study this topic in more detail for yourself, we've recently produced a course called, after the book, God's Design for Man and Woman, in conjunction with Bible Mesh, that's available through BibleMesh.com. And for this course, we've recorded over 30 videos and include much of the content of the book, God's Design for Man and Woman. I think that would be an ideal resource for personal study, for a small group study in your church, or even for a college or seminary credit.
Great. I hadn't thought about that one. I'm glad you mentioned it. Is that available also on your website, Biblical Foundation?
Yeah, biblicalfoundations.org. Absolutely.
Great. All right. Well, we've been talking to Andreas Kostenberger about his new book that he has co-edited with Tom Schreiner. The title of the book is Women in the Church, An Interpretation and Application of 1 Timothy 2:9-15. This is its third edition. It's a great piece of work, solid scholarship, reliable help for understanding this important passage of Scripture. We encourage you to take a look at it. Andreas, thanks a lot for being with us.
Absolutely. Anytime.